Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the 29th annual Henri Renard Lecture presented each year by the Creighton University Department of Philosophy. The guest speaker will be John McDowell, professor of philosophy at the University of Pittsburgh and author of Mind and Body, regarded as one of the most important contributions to philosophy in the last 20 years. His topic will be autonomy and its burdens. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 19, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Patrick Murray, professor of philosophy at Creighton University.
One of Professor McDowell's philosophical preoccupations has been, in his words, to achieve a satisfactory understanding of experience's openness to objective reality. His renewal of Aristotle's effort to understand our place in nature as rational animals has led him deep into the philosophies of Wilfred Sellers, taught also at the University of Pittsburgh, Immanuel Kant, and G.W.F. Hegel. Professor McDowell holds a prominent place among those recent philosophers who are reversing the trend of modern philosophy in order to, in Frank B. Farrell's words, recover the world. Please join me in welcoming Professor John McDowell to Creighton University as our 29th Henri Renard Lecture.
Well, thank you very much for that generous introduction. It's a great honor to be invited to give the Renard Lecture. I'm very sensitive to the honor. Thank you for inviting me. So, autonomy and its burdens. From the derivation of the word, autonomy should mean something like self-government, being subject to laws that are one's own. And that suggests that the concept of autonomy has its original home in a political context. Self-government, in the most obvious sense, is what, say, a formerly subject nation achieves when it liberates itself from an imperial power. Here we already see a connection between the idea of autonomy and an idea of freedom. And I want to hold on to the thought that autonomy is a kind of freedom when I move away, as I'm going to soon, from a political understanding of the concept of autonomy. But staying for the moment in a political context, we can shift from autonomy as an achievement of a nation to autonomy as a characteristic of individuals. Autonomy is self-government. Self-government is being oneself, the source of the laws that one is subject to. And we can think of that as a characteristic of individuals who live under democratic political arrangements. That idea, the idea of citizens who give themselves the law, fits most easily in a direct democracy, where legislating is done in an assembly of all the citizens. Think of how things are supposed to have been in Periclean Athens. Or we might think of the ideal commonwealth that Rousseau envisages in On the Social Contract. But then perhaps we can extend the idea of giving oneself the law to political arrangements of a more familiar kind, in which legislating is entrusted to representatives. That would be to exploit the thought, a perfectly natural thought, that if a person's representative does something, including legislating in particular, and in doing it is acting as that person's representative, we can count the person as vicariously doing it herself. But the idea of autonomy that I want to work with isn't a political idea. Autonomy is self-government, but the idea of government, which is obviously in the first instance a political idea, easily lends itself to metaphorical applications. And the concept of autonomy as self-government or self-determination that I want to work with doesn't need a narrowly political context. Autonomy in the sense in which I want to consider it, is the capacity of an individual to determine her thought and action for herself. There's still that connection with freedom. Somebody who determines the shape of her own life is free in an obvious sense. Let me stress that autonomy is a capacity. No one is self-determining all the time, but lapses don't show that a person doesn't have a capacity. Still, the way to understand a capacity is to understand its exercises, not the lapses. So, how should we understand the idea of determining one's thought or action for oneself? Well, I think the best answer starts like this. One is self-determining to the extent that one thinks or acts as one does for reasons that, in thinking or acting as one does, one is responding to as the reasons they are. So responsiveness to reasons as reasons is the key concept in understanding the concept of autonomy that I want. Responding to reasons as the reasons they are manifests rationality, and obviously enough, rationality is what separates rational animals from the rest, animals that aren't rational. That's to invoke a traditional distinction within the animal kingdom. Now, I want to dwell on this traditional distinction for a while in order to explain what I mean by talking about responding to reasons as the reasons they are. We can respect the traditional distinction of rational animals from other animals and still acknowledge a sense in which animals that aren't rational can respond to what are in fact reasons. The point is that the responses of animals that aren't rational aren't responses to reasons as the reasons they are. For instance, animals of many kinds, including animals that aren't rational, have fleeing, right, running away as part of their repertoire of behavior. Consider how prey animals respond to the presence of predators. And fleeing is responding to something that is, in a perfectly good sense, a reason for that response. Say, danger, or at least something that the animal that flees takes to be danger. That's not something that just happens to be true about the behavior we call fleeing. That's a point about the very idea of fleeing. Right? Fleeing is, just as such, behavior in which an animal responds to perceived danger. And perceived danger makes the behavior intelligible in a distinctive way. Perceived danger is a reason for the response. It's not just a trigger of the response. But responding to danger by fleeing need not be responding to danger as the reason it is, in the sense that I want to put into place. It can be, but only when the response comes from a rational animal. To count as being able to respond to reasons as reasons, to respond to reasons as the reasons they are, one must be able to, as it were, step back from the fact that a certain circumstance, for instance, perceived danger, inclines one towards acting in a certain way. For instance, fleeing. Step back from that and raise the question whether one should act in that way. If one then resolves that question and acts in the light of one's resolution of it, one's acting reflects the capacity that distinguishes rational animals from other animals. Such action exemplifies a capacity for a kind of freedom, a kind of freedom that isn't found in the lives of creatures that can't engage in that sort of reflection. Reflection is what you do at the stepped back standpoint. The behavior of an animal that isn't rational is the immediate outcome of motivational forces that are part of its animal nature. Consider, for instance, an antelope that takes flight when it senses the presence of a lion. What the antelope does is, in a certain sense, not under its control. Of course, the behavior is voluntary, so in another sense, it is under the antelope's control. Contrast a human being who, in my metaphorical sense, steps back from a circumstance that tends to elicit a certain behavioral inclination from her. For instance, consider a human being who steps back from a perceived danger. That's a kind of thing that tends to elicit an inclination to run away in a human being, no less than in an antelope. To step back from a circumstance is to contemplate it as a candidate for being a reason to do something. Right? For instance, run away. Suppose the person, having stepped back, determines that she should make the circumstance her reason for acting and acts for that reason. There's then a sense in which what she does is determined by herself. In contrast, the antelope's behavior is determined by forces that naturally operate on it. Or maybe we should say that naturally operate in it. When one steps back, it becomes up to one whether to acknowledge, as a reason for acting, a candidate for being a reason for acting that's brought to one's attention by eliciting a motivational impulse. For instance, an impulse to run away. And if one does acknowledge a consideration as a reason for acting in some way, it's up to one whether to act in that way, or perhaps to recognize more compelling reasons for doing something else and do the something else instead. One might, for instance, accept that a danger that one faces is a reason for running away, but determine that there are stronger reasons for standing one's ground. If one decides that the consideration in question, so the danger in the case that I'm working with, is indeed a sufficient reason for acting, and then acts on it, one satisfies the original motivational impulse, the impulse that brought the consideration into view as a candidate for being a reason. But in this case, what explains one's acting, as one does, is the consideration that one has determined to make one's reason for acting, not the brute pressure of the motivational impulse, as in the case of animals that aren't rational. Well, I've been working with this image of stepping back. That's an image for a distanced orientation towards circumstances that otherwise would have nearly induced inclinations to do certain things. It seems plausible that this distanced orientation becomes a possibility with the acquisition of language. If one can say how things are, there's a danger. One can hold a circumstance with a tendency to influence one's motivations at arm's length, as it were. Describing a circumstance gives one a means to adopt a partly contemplative attitude towards it, as opposed to just being practically immersed in it. The ability to frame a circumstance in words puts one in a position to ask oneself whether it constitutes a reason for doing what it inclines one to do, and if so, whether the reason is enough to act on. But I don't mean to suggest that the acquisition of language is intelligible first, in advance of this capacity to step back, this capacity to hold circumstances at arm's length, as if language comes first and brings in its train the ability to adopt a distanced orientation towards one's predicaments. What seems plausible is rather something like this: the capacity to use language and the capacity to adopt a distanced attitude towards circumstances one finds oneself in are two elements in a bundle of capacities that we need to understand as a whole. So in the picture I'm offering, the capacity to respond to reasons as such belongs with language, and it marks a discontinuity in the animal kingdom. rational animals are animals of a quite special kind. They're animals with logos, really helpful Greek term. Sometimes it needs to be translated language, sometimes it needs to be translated reason. And here, both translations are appropriate at once. The idea of animals with logos encapsulates the idea that the class of rational animals coincides with the class of linguistic animals, animals with language. But as I've said, animals that aren't rational, in the sense of this traditional distinction, rational animals and the rest, can be responsive to reasons in a less demanding sense, not to the reasons as the reasons they are. To stay with the same example, what I've said is that animals that aren't rational can, without qualification, be said to respond to danger, or at least to what they take to be danger, with behavior for which danger, or at least perceived danger, is a reason. So I can insist on the discontinuity between rational animals and other animals, the discontinuity marked by the traditional distinction, without needing to play down an important continuity. It isn't that rationality, in the sense in which rationality marks the traditional distinction, springs into being out of nothing with the onset of language. The relation between a reason in the demanding sense that I'm working with and what it's a reason for has intelligible precursors in ways in which perceived environmental circumstances engage with merely animal motivational tendencies. That is, ways in which we can make sense of stretches of the lives of animals without language, animals that aren't rational in the demanding sense that I'm working with. I've been introducing the idea of responsiveness to reasons as the reasons they are, in terms of the idea of stepping back from circumstances in the light of which merely animal behavior, without this distanced orientation, would have been intelligible as response to reasons in a less demanding sense. Now, of course, I don't mean to imply that that's all there is to be said about responsiveness to reasons as such. What I've been describing so far is a transformation of the kind of practical competence that's operative in coping with the problems and predicaments of merely animal life. And that's obviously not the whole truth about coming to be an inhabitant of what Wilfred Sellers, a hero of mine, called the logical space of reasons. For one thing, I suggested that the capacity for a distanced attitude towards features of one's environment emerges together with the ability to say how things are. So far, I've been focusing on practical reasons, reasons for doing things. But the idea of the ability to say how things are presupposes responsiveness to theoretical reasons, right? Reasons for believing things. So this brings another region of the space of reasons into the picture, reasons that appeal to theoretical rationality as opposed to practical rationality. Theoretical rationality, right, theoretical responsiveness to reasons as reasons, includes, for instance, things like the ability to weigh evidence, not provided for by my image of stepping back. And anyway, there's of course more to practical rationality than the transformed counterpart to merely animal practical intelligence, in terms of which I've introduced the idea. Think, for instance, about ethical reasons. Ethical reasons are distinct from the sort of thing that's responded to by animals that aren't rational. And the difference lies along a different dimension from the one that I've been trying to bring into view with the image of stepping back from circumstances. So that's just to say there's a whole lot more to the idea of rationality in the sense of responsiveness to reasons as such than what I've brought into view with the image of stepping back. Now, I want to make one more point about the idea of rationality that I'm exploiting in order to put in place a way of thinking about autonomy. The point is this. What matters for rationality, in the sense that I want to exploit, is the capacity to step back and assess whether putative reasons warrant action or belief, the capacity to do that. Rationality may be operative even when the capacity to step back isn't being exercised. Responding to a reason as the reason it is, by doing something or by forming a belief, doesn't require that one actually reflects about whether some consideration is a sufficient rational warrant for whatever it is, doing whatever one does, believing whatever one believes. Sometimes it's enough that one could reflect. Imagine, for instance, somebody following a marked trail who, at a crossing of paths, goes to the right in response to a signpost that, as we naturally say, points that way. It points to the right. The person's going to the right may be a rational response to the signpost. It may manifest understanding of the signpost's significance, significance in a Finnish sense. The signpost points to the right. That's its significance. If that's so, I mean, if this behavior is responding to the signpost as a reason for going to the right, then the behavior stands in contrast with the outwardly similar reaction of a non-rational animal that's maybe been trained to go to the left or right in conditioned response to objects of certain shapes. Now, it would be absurd to say that if going to the right is to be a response to the signposts pointing to the right, as the reason for going to the right that it is, the person must have, in my metaphorical sense, stepped back and made an explicit determination that the signpost gives her a reason for going to the right. What's required is just that her reason for going to the right is that the signpost points to the right. It has to be the fact that the signpost points to the right that explains her going to the right. And what shows that that's the explanation may be no more than that she can afterwards answer the question, why did you go to the right? By saying, there was a signpost pointing to the right. She doesn't need to have explicitly adverted at the time to the reason that the signpost afforded and decided on that basis to go to the right. The point here is that rationality in the demanding sense, rationality in the sense of responsiveness to reasons as the reasons that they are, can be operative in quite unreflective behavior. Characteristically, it will be quite unreflective if one goes to the right in response to a signpost which one understands. And similarly, rationality can be operative in quite unreflective belief formation. I'm not recommending a picture in which rationality is operative only when there's intellectual activity. Okay, well, that was the first section, putting in place a conception of autonomy cashed out in terms of rationality in the sense of responsiveness to reasons as such. So now I shift to the second section, and burdensomeness will slowly emerge. So what I've been doing so far is sketching a conception of autonomy as rationality. Autonomy is, as I said at the beginning, self-government, self-determination. And the idea is one is self-determining when one's thinking or acting are determined by reasons that one recognizes as such. So rational animals have the capacity to appreciate the force of reasons and respond to it. Actually determining oneself is exercising that capacity, actually thinking or acting in response to reasons that one recognizes as such. The idea is that's what it is to be in control of one's own life, to be such that the relevant regions of one's life are shaped as they are because of reasons that one recognizes as such. Now, if we approach the idea of autonomy in that way, we're putting it in a normative framework. The account of autonomy that I've been sketching centers on a normative concept. You might say the concept of the authority of reasons, or just their force in a natural metaphor that I actually used a few minutes back. To exercise autonomy is to subject oneself to the normative force of reasons. That's a self-subjection that's at the same time a self-determination. If one conforms to the authority of a reason that one appreciates as such, one's thought or action, whatever it is that one's conforming in respect of, is determined by the power in one, by virtue of which one's able to recognize that authority and think or act accordingly. And it's in exercising that power that one is most truly oneself. I think that's the content of a striking image that Kant adapts from Rousseau, in which freedom is obedience to a self-legislated law, a law that one legislates for oneself. If one recognizes a consideration as having the authority that belongs to a reason, one recognizes conforming to it, not as obedience to a requirement imposed on one from outside, but as precisely what's required for one's thought or action to be one's own. It's oneself who holds oneself to these requirements, not an external power. So, self-subjection that's at the same time self-determination. Now, there's a connection between the idea of individual autonomy, understood in terms of responsiveness to reasons as such, and the idea of belonging to a community. And getting that straight is going to be the theme of my second section. I've just mentioned Kant and Rousseau. I'd already mentioned Rousseau way back in the first section of the lecture. I'm going to say a little more about those thinkers in order to sketch a historical context for the connection between autonomy and community that I've just put in place as a topic, something to think more about. So back to Rousseau. In On the Social Contract, Rousseau describes an ideal commonwealth in which individual citizens literally give themselves the law. And he represents becoming a citizen as a metaphysical transformation, a transformation in which human individuals become possessors of freedom in a sense that has no conceivable application to ordinary animals. Rousseau's social contract is an imagined institutional context in which, if the institutions he envisages could be realized, which is something that he thinks could happen, if at all, only in highly constrained conditions, then individuals would achieve a freedom that would consist in having their action determined by a rational will. And that's clearly a version of the core of the conception of autonomy that I've been trying to put in place. Now, Kant is struck by this conception of freedom as the power of legislating for oneself. And he rescues a version of it from Rousseau's, let me say, pessimism about its being realized. Right? Rousseau thinks only in the actually wildly implausible institutional setup could it happen. Kant rescues it from that. Kant detaches the relevant sort of freedom from political arrangements whose possibility of actualization might be an issue, as it is for Rousseau. Kant's kingdom of ends is an institution at most metaphorically. I mean, it's not even notionally an institution like Rousseau's ideal commonwealth. In Kant, Rousseau's idea of a freedom that would consist in obedience to the results of legislative acts of one's own becomes a vivid metaphor, a way of emphasizing the sense in which conforming one's thought and action to the authority of reasons is the very opposite of abdicating control over one's life to an alien power. to round off this sketch of a relevant bit of the history of philosophy, it's only meant to be a sketch, let me bring Hegel into the picture. Hegel follows Kant in taking a conception of freedom like Rousseau's away from a strictly political setting. Like Kant, Hegel doesn't identify autonomy with citizenship. But in another way, Hegel reverts to Rousseau. For Hegel, it's only in an actual, historically realized social context that we can make sense of the emergence of this metaphysically special kind of being, the autonomous individual. Now, it's a delicate question how exactly we should understand the connection between autonomy and community. After that historical excursus, I can say that this question is central in the interpretation of Hegel's philosophy. And I'm going to come back to Hegel at a couple of points later in the lecture. But meanwhile, I'm going to pursue the connection between autonomy and community in its own right in order to begin on bringing up the way autonomy can be felt as burdensome. In the first section of this lecture, I link the capacity to recognize circumstances as reasons for acting with the capacity to adopt a distanced orientation towards circumstances one finds oneself in. And I suggested that we should understand the capacity for this distanced orientation as part of a package with being initiated into language. So I can say the relevant community is, in the first instance, a linguistic community. One acquires the capacity to step back, along with becoming a member of a linguistic community. Language came into view in the bit of my first section that I've just recalled in connection with just one aspect of what it is to inhabit the space of reasons. I was talking there about how circumstances that elicit animal motivations get transformed into considerations that constitute reasons for acting in a more demanding sense. And I stress that that's only part of what needs to be said about rationality in the sense that marks the traditional distinction within the animal kingdom. There are also reasons for belief, I said, and even in the sphere of acting, the transformation that I was talking about doesn't make sense of ethical reasons. But the role of language in making the transformation that I talked about intelligible is a case of something general. It's a case of something that applies to reasons of all kinds. Human beings are born with a potential for rationality in the demanding sense. They're born with a potential for the capacity to respond to reasons as such. But they have that potential raised to actuality by way of being initiated into a conception of what's a reason for what that is, to begin with, simply handed down to them, embodied in a collection of practices that they're brought up into. Learning a shared language, which we can conceive as, among other things, a repository of tradition. Tradition picks up, handed down, as I said. Learning a shared language is central here in the actualization of the potential for responsiveness to reasons as such. Of course, being initiated into a tradition can't by itself ensure that what someone takes to be reasons really are the reasons they seem to her to be. Someone may think or act in the light of something that isn't really a reason for thinking or acting as she does. Her grasp of what's a reason for what is defective. Maybe the presence of a supposed reason in the conception of reasons that she's had handed down to her, or maybe the rational weight that it's taken to have in that conception, reflects a mere prejudice that informs the thinking of her community. I suppose, for instance, that someone's conforming her thought or action to a supposed reason reflects her believing that race or gender settles a person's proper station in life. In a case like that, what ultimately explains the person's thought or action isn't the force of a reason that she recognizes as such. I mean, what we have here is only an illusion of an instance of that. The explanatory weight falls through the supposed reason to whatever explains her taking it to be a reason. Our explanation of why she thinks or acts as she does comes to rest on how her upbringing was shaped by the hold of prejudice in the community that she was brought up into. Now, that stands in contrast with how things are when someone's upbringing has, as we might say, opened her eyes to the actual layout of the space of reasons. In that case, understanding of her thought or action can find firm ground in her recognition of a reason as the reason it is. If that's so, her thought or action reflects her rational self. It doesn't reflect just the contingencies of her upbringing. Of course, in that case too, where the eyes are open to the true layout of the space of reasons, we can be interested in how a person got to be that way. Our interest then is in how she came to be responsive to the genuine reasons that she is responsive to. If someone's thought or action is intelligible in terms of her correctly appreciating the rational force of genuine reasons, saying how she came to be capable of that appreciation is a change of explanatory direction. It's a kind of appendix to an explanation that's complete in its own terms and reveals what it explains as a reflection of the person's own self. Whereas if someone acts or thinks in the light of a defective grasp of the layout of the space of reasons, an understanding of why she sees things as she does is a necessary supplement to an explanation. And the explanation reveals what it explains as reflecting mere contingencies of the person's formation, not her rational self, exclusively at work. There are limits to how defective a tradition can be if being initiated into it is to count as acquiring a conception, even a partly wrong conception, of the layout of the space of reasons, and hence an actualization, even only a partial actualization, of the potential for autonomy. I mean, if we try to imagine too much error in a conception of what's a reason for what, the attempt undermines itself. It becomes impossible to suppose someone who had such a conception would be enough in touch with reasons to count as having even a defective grasp of them. If we now recall the view of languages as repositories of tradition, and among other things, tradition about what's a reason for what, we can see that this limit on the possibility of error is a way of approaching the thought that nothing can be both recognizable from inside a linguistic practice as another linguistic practice and in some radical way unintelligible from there. Now, here I have in mind a couple of landmark articles in analytic philosophy, one by Donald Davidson called On the Very Idea of a Conceptual Scheme, and a kind of variation on Davidson's theme by Richard Rorty, an article, The World Well Lost. So you can't be completely wrong. You're guaranteed to be sort of right just by being onto reasons at all. Now, I've been stressing the difference between responding to a genuine reason whose rational force one appreciates and responding to something that merely seems to one to be a reason. Certainly, one has to have the capacity to recognize and respond to reasons, if something is even to seem to one to be a reason. But the idea I've been pushing is that one is actually self-determining only if what explains one's thought or action is a genuine reason, recognized by one as such. If what one acts on is something that merely seems to one to be a reason, then what ultimately explains one's thought or action is whatever explains it seeming to one to be a reason. One's thought or action is ultimately determined by one's upbringing or one's social milieu or whatever it is that figures in that explanation. not by oneself, whereas if it's a genuine perception of a reason, it's explained by oneself. It's oneself that accounts for the thought or action. Given that conception of how and why the difference matters, it's natural to hanker after a criterion to single out the regions of the space of reasons where, as I put it, one's eyes are open to its true layout, and mark them off from regions of the space of reasons where the conception that one finds oneself with is skewed by prejudice or whatever other distorting influence. But there is no criterion. At any rate, if by that we mean some general formula that it might be possible to apply to mark off genuine reasons from impostors, it's incumbent on one to reflect about whether what seem to one to be reasons really are reasons, doing one's best not to be taken in by impostors. And there's no straightforward, as it were, mechanical way to guard against the risk of being taken in by impostors. Here we can begin to appreciate why we can't understand autonomy as simply an aspect of belonging to a community. Here we begin to appreciate the thought that autonomy is a responsibility that sits on individuals. One may be confident that the practices of giving reasons that one's been brought up into correspond to reasons as they really are. Even so, it would be a way of giving up one's autonomy if one equated the question whether something that initially strikes one as a reason really is a reason with the question whether acknowledging it as a reason conforms to the conception of what's a reason for what that's embodied in those practices, the ones one has been brought up into. On such a question, is this really a reason? The response, this is what my community thinks, or this is how I've been brought up to think, is not to the point. One has to resolve for oneself the question whether the way one finds oneself inclined to think is the right way to think. Now, what resources does one have for addressing this question? Well, only those that one has been equipped with by one's upbringing, along with any previous reflection that's modified one's inherited conception of what's a reason for what. To consider whether the view of some region of the space of reasons that one finds oneself with is skewed or distorted or whatever, the only thing one can do is to ask oneself whether it coheres with one's view of other regions of the space of reasons, which one must just trust for the duration of one's reflection about the reason that's up for reflective scrutiny. I mean that to pick up a familiar image, image from Otto Neurath, of a mariner repairing his vessel, or at least inspecting it for seaworthiness, while it's afloat, not able to put it ashore. One can be confident only that one has if one has the space of reasons in view at all, one can't be completely wrong about it. That's the thought I found in Davidson and Rorty. So this is a mode of reflection in which one asks oneself, as I said, whether one's conception of a region of the space of reasons coheres with other regions of the space of reasons as one sees them, which for the moment one must simply trust, though their status may come into question later. Coheres, I said, what coherence comes to is analogous to what coherence comes to in disputes in, say, common law, or maybe constitutional law, where the questions that are asked are questions like, is this decision in the spirit of those previous decisions? Whether something is in the spirit of something else isn't the kind of thing that can be checked mechanically, takes judgment. In a famous phrase in his discussion of self-consciousness, Hegel speaks of I that is we and we that is I. And a way to frame the question how individual autonomy is related to membership in a community is as a question about how to interpret that idea, a pregnant idea, I that is we that is I. What I've been doing is stressing the I, the autonomous individual, I should say it's important not to overbalance in that direction. We shouldn't lose sight of the point I made about how the potential for autonomy is actualized in an individual. It's actualized, I said, by being initiated into a tradition. Tradition that's embodied in shared practices, in the first instance, linguistic practices. And one could put that in the terms of Hegel's phrase by saying, one becomes an I, an autonomous subject, capable of resolving questions about reasons for oneself, only by becoming one of a we. A kind of routine case of that, by learning to speak English, becoming one of us English speakers. Going on a bit with that, it would be wrong to interpret my stress so far on the autonomous I as implying that reflection about whether to commit oneself to an element of the view of the space of reasons that one finds oneself with, or maybe to modify it, is a task for a solitary individual. Of course not. One can and should exploit the wisdom of others. We shouldn't exclude cooperative investigations in which one trusts one's collaborators. And it would be missing the point if one took it that the reflection that's incumbent on one about whether what strike one as reasons really are reasons could be satisfactorily resolved by a merely private conviction, as if it would be no problem for what one took to be a resolution if one failed utterly in all attempts to bring other members of the relevant we, the relevant us, I guess, to see the result of one's reflection as a view they should at least respect, even if maybe they don't want to adopt it. So all of that's to say, don't overbalance in the direction of the I, but all of that leaves in place the fact that autonomy requires one to acknowledge the force of the reasons on which one thinks or acts as the individual I one is, not as an element in a we. As I said, to think that this is how we think settles the reflective question would be to abandon one's claim to autonomy. One can't delegate the task of addressing the reflective question to the accumulated wisdom of one's community. Before one could invoke the wisdom of one's community, one would need to satisfy oneself that wisdom is indeed what it is. So that's why autonomy is intelligibly, and indeed rightly, felt as burdensome. The burden of autonomy is the responsibility to reflect for oneself about the credentials of putative reasons for thought or action, in full awareness that one can't rely uncritically on any supposed wisdom that one has merely inherited. If one takes things on trust from others, one is oneself responsible for doing that. So one can't do that lightly. The condition of belonging to, say, a collaborative scientific investigation, right, where you trust the other people to do bits of the investigation, take over their results, that condition is quite special. There's no ultimate ground for confidence that one is right about what's a reason for what, and hence that one is genuinely self-determining in some region of one's life, as opposed to just reflecting contingencies of one's formation, apart from whatever materials for reflection one can lay hands on for oneself. In one's reflection, one will find certain considerations persuasive, but one has to be aware that whether one's right to find them persuasive is itself, in principle, up for reflective questioning at some other stage in the Neuratian inspection of one's boat. The boat has to be kept floating. Nothing is immune to reflective scrutiny. In another Hegelian image, this from the preface to the Phenomenology of Spirit, everything is fluid, nothing is firm. I'm trying to stress the sense of, wow, intolerable burden. Okay, so that was the second part in which I tried to put in place an understanding of the second part of my title, really only one burden. Autonomy as burdensome. Third part, this will be quite brief, you'll be glad to know. Well, it's understandable that there should be a temptation to avoid this burden of responsibility, this obligation to try to get things right for oneself. The obligation can be daunting. I've been urging that the scope of one's responsibility includes everything that one might appeal to in the course of one's reflection. So there are no foundations for reflection that are once and for all firm. Now, there are some unsatisfactory tendencies in philosophy that we can understand in the light of that temptation, the temptation to avoid the burden of responsibility for getting things right. Appreciating how daunting the burden can be can help us to make sense of some things that go wrong in philosophy. And I'm going to end by just barely mentioning three such tendencies. The first, which I think is the least interesting, is a temptation to give up the very idea of getting things right. The burden of the obligation to reflect that comes with autonomy wouldn't sit so heavily on us if we could stop supposing there are right and wrong views of what's a reason for what. If we could suppose that the most a person can aspire to is something she can find satisfying for herself, with no claim to objectivity or universality. The most obvious expression of this way of shirking responsibility is one or other kind of relativism. Not, I think, very interesting, but intelligible as an avoidance of the burden. The second mode of avoidance of responsibility that I want to consider is what Sellars called the myth of the given. That's his label for a genre of ways in which philosophy goes astray. In general terms, the myth of the given is the idea that things can make themselves available for knowing in a transaction in which the knower is just passive, a transaction that doesn't involve, on the side of the knower, capacities for whose proper functioning one is responsible, so that one's called on to reflect about them and improve them, if that's what reflection recommends. I mean, that's what we should realize, that any transaction in which things are given to one for knowing does turn on capacities of that sort, capacities for the improvement of which, if necessary, one is responsible. The most obvious expression of this idea, the idea of the mythical given, is in traditional empiricism, in which features of reality are supposed to impress themselves immediately on subjects who need be no more than equipped with functioning sense organs and maybe awake. And Sellars himself focuses mostly on an empiricistic version of the myth. But in the preamble to his polemic against traditional empiricism, he makes it clear that he doesn't think the myth of the given is exclusively the province of empiricists. Traditional rationalism, for instance, has its own version. In a rationalistic version of the myth of the given, its features of the independently constituted intelligible structure of reality, rather than features of the empirical world, that immediately impress themselves on knowing subjects, not now through the senses, but by way of a postulated capacity for insight into that structure. And in many ways, a picture like that is, of course, very unlike traditional empiricism. But it's like traditional empiricism in that the supposed knowledge-yielding transaction is conceived as drawing on nothing for whose proper functioning the knowing subjects could be supposed to be responsible. So we can suppose that both these versions of the myth of the given, and so both the main tendencies that clash inconclusively in much of modern philosophy, owe at least some of their attractiveness to an intelligible wish to avoid the burden of responsibility. Well, that was sketchy. I'm going to have to be even sketchier about the third temptation I want to mention, which is a tendency in trying to make sense of the I that is we and the we that is I to tip the scale too far to the side of the we. As I acknowledged, one can become an autonomous I only by becoming one of a we. And as I also acknowledged, aspiring to get things right must be aspiring to a position on which one could, in principle, win consensus from others, at least on its being worthy of respect, something on which reasonable people can agree to differ, if not on its being correct. I mean, ideally on its being correct, but respect worthy would be a backup. But those acknowledgments of a relevance for the we that the I has to be one of don't shift the burden of responsibility to the community. And discomfort at the burden of responsibility can encourage a philosophy that implies such a shift. This is a delicate matter. Saying something like, we're not on our own, it can be saying something that's obviously right in some sense. But in the kind of philosophy I mean, a thought like that, we're not on our own, becomes a false comfort in the face of the burden of responsibility, the responsibility shared among others. This is a thing that happens in some readings of Hegel. As I said a while ago, Hegel insists on putting the conception of autonomy as self-determination, a conception that he inherits from Kant, in a historically actual social context. And that strand in Hegel is sometimes read as if its effect is to lighten for each of us the burden of responsibility for getting things right by treating it as sitting on the community rather than the individual. That's a case of what I described as a false comfort. Against that, I think the point of Hegel's insistence on a social context is just that self-consciousness is formed in a communal context. That leaves responsibility for getting things right lying just as heavily as ever on the individual. As Hegel sees things, a mark of a mature modern consciousness is a clear-sighted acceptance of one's individual responsibility for seeing to it that one is properly attuned to the layout of the space of reasons. One is self-determining when one's thought or action is determined by reasons that one recognizes as such. The capacity for self-determination brings with it a special obligation to do one's best to ensure that the reasons one seems to recognize as such really are reasons. This obligation rests on each of us as individuals. We can disown it only if we're prepared to renounce the capacity for freedom that is our gift as animals of the special kind that we belong to. It's a gift that's also a burden, and there are understandable temptations towards philosophical moves whose attractiveness lies in their seeming to lessen the burden of the obligation. But the right attitude towards the burden is an open-eyed acceptance. Thank you for listening patiently.
You've been listening to a program from the Creighton University Lecture Series. We've heard the 29th annual Henri Renard Lecture presented each year by the Creighton University Department of Philosophy. The speaker was John McDowell, professor of philosophy at the University of Pittsburgh and author of Mind and Body. His topic was Autonomy and Its Burdens. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 19, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.